Hi, welcome to Produce Time with the Greengrocers.
No, John, that's the wrong podcast.
Oh.
This is the other podcast we do.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I thought we were doing our Greengrocers podcast.
I love that podcast,
it
but
is
that's
great,
not
right?
The one we're doing right
I
now.
I have all these alfalfa sprouts.
Well, we have run episode 145 of that one, and yet no one has heard it, so maybe we shouldn't pursue that one.
All right. Maybe subtly, psychologically, I was trying to bind these
I respect
together
that. Nonetheless, the mission at hand is a different podcast.
Hi, welcome to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast. Sitting next to me at a round table in our new offices is Will Hines.
Yep, and sitting next to me reflexively, therefore, is John Frusciante.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
With us, as always, is our intern, Sypha Sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Sypha.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Intern Keaton Patty, comfortably off mic.
Mm-hmm. Comfortably for all of us.
Yes, we have to keep his power at bay.
We're happy to be back after, a month?
After a month, yeah. We couldn't get our crap together.
Yeah. You can swear on this podcast. It's okay.
I'm not too comfortable with that.
Okay.
We couldn't get our S together.
And with us this week, our guest is Brandon Gardner.
Hello.
Yay. Hello, Brandon Yay. Gardner.
Trying to get Brandon on the podcast for also about a month and a half or so.
Yeah. And, well, he's tough to schedule. We're tough to schedule, but it all worked out.
We're all tough people.
Everything's difficult.
Hi, Brandon.
Hello, Brandon.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited to be on this podcast. I feel like it's one of those things you need to check off.
It's a milestone,
it's a
bucket
list.
It's one of the few that you haven't checked off.
Yeah.
That's true.
All right, let's quit bullshitting.
Right. Let's get to it. We bullshitted for a while.
Yeah.
I'm only kidding. I have nothing to follow that.
Will Hines has a sort of binary bullshit switch that clicks off immediately in his brain. Some kind of like really watered down Philip K. Dick character.
Oh, I would love it.
Make me think of... When I first got on a Herald team,
Was in what, 1972?
1972.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember your bio.
This, because, yeah, you spoke about it.
I love this so much.
Because I think, like, the first line of it, or in the very beginning of it, was that I've been trying for 2 years to get on this wall of pictures.
I can remember it more exactly than that. Is like, Brandon Gardner, you know, was on the team Bastion and has been improvising since this year and has spent, like, an embarrassingly huge amount of effort trying to become one of the faces on this page. I think
Which
it was something
super
like
true.
That. Yeah. I read that and I was like, I like this dude.
What page?
The performer's page. Which
all
was relative.
Was be on the performer.
I'm supposed to be on there, and I can't get my picture on there.
Oh, I gotta send. Didn't I send you a new thing?
No,
I gotta send that to
please.
You.
Audience, if you have any issues with the website, be a guest in our podcast.
Bring it up,
and then we'll get done.
All right.
But Gardner, I remember that, and the performer's page wasn't all that new. It was like a couple years old, but just that I was like, oh yeah, this is something that people are watching and they know about it and they want to be part of it.
For sure.
And you calling attention to it, I don't know. I found it endearing. Found it honest
it was
and funny.
Very genuine. Because I came to New York, like I think a lot of people come to New York with a lot of different plans or goals.
Yes.
And I came only to be on a Herald team.
Really? You came to New York to be in a Herald team?
That's and I felt if I did that, I would be done with life.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So can we just do, before we get into this, you know how the top of a Wikipedia page has the little table of contents so you know what's coming?
Sure.
Can you just do like a quick bullet point summary of your improv story?
Great.
Sypha and I are signaling to each other.
Of the background noise to see if that's...
No. I just put a note. I made a note to myself to send you those instructions on Workflowy, a new to-do list app that I've been using.
Oh, yeah?
Thanks to Adam Frucci.
Ooh. Frucci gets stuff done. Yeah. And he is a compatriot of Gardner.
Cable of, mm-hmm. Close friend. I guess first one would be maybe high school theater.
Okay.
Then college improv.
Right.
And you went to Binghamton.
I went
right?
to Binghamton University, SUNY Binghamton,
mm-hmm.
where I did improv there. I guess the next one would be maybe summer intensive, if we're breaking it down into like real chunks.
Go a little bit broader than that.
So classes.
Yeah,
right?
UCB classes.
UCB classes and indie team, I would maybe factor that in too.
Yep, Big Tobacco.
Big Tobacco. Mm-hmm. Then Bastion.
Herald team, right?
Herald team. Then I guess Ruben and Curfew maybe is grouped together.
Yes, I agree.
Sure. Yeah.
Weekend team.
Weekend team. I guess maybe Torco is a chapter.
Yeah,
sure.
Mod night.
Let's have a ball. Summer in there.
Yeah.
Improv nerds. Teaching.
I guess
those are the ones.
Yes.
Yeah.
Pretty good. That feels like a good table. Now I feel oriented.
Good.
Good.
So you said that you came to New York City, I guess, from SUNY Binghamton to be on a Harold team.
That was the goal.
So how did you even know, like, how did you get, how did that happen?
I was one of those guys that, Skidmore has the National College Comedy Festival.
Right.
And I was one of those guys who, that's how I got into
UCB. A lot of people discovered it through that.
That's how I met Gabrus, and we, Gabrus and I bonded. He went to Marist, and we, I think, had,
John
in my
Gabrus.
Opinion, John Gabrus. Had the worst college improv groups at this festival. We were terrible. I think my group was worse. His group was worse only. They were probably one of the funnier groups, but they were the group that made a lot of people uncomfortable. And so we sort of hung out because no one else wanted to hang out with us. Also, we were like, I was like really into weightlifting.
Yeah,
in
you
college.
Were super jacked.
So super jacked.
You're jacked so now, Gabrus. And you look like Gandhi on a hunger strike compared to what you were in college.
Yeah,
you
I
were
do.
Like this weird cartoon character.
I was like 30 pounds more muscular.
Yeah.
Wow.
You looked weird.
Yeah, it was a weird look for me.
Yeah.
It wasn't a good look. I don't think it was
That
attractive.
Photo I saw of you was like, it was like you were part of some eugenics experiment. Like you were like
really
pumped
strange.
Up in a real
yeah, almost
unnatural...
like Captain America where someone
yeah,
like,
yeah, it looked like
my
you
body.
Had gone through some strange process. And you were doing comedy.
And I was doing comedy,
it would be like
seeing
Captain America
good,
like cross-stitching an aphorism into like a piece of quilt. It like did not look like it went together
strange.
At all.
And Gabrus was also really muscular.
Yeah, mm-hmm. big rugby player.
So no one wanted to hang out with the two big
yeah,
jack
bullies.
Guys.
You're going to take their
right.
money.
Yeah, the two alpha males. Gonna,
yeah.
yeah.
But
push everybody
we're
into
proud
a locker.
Of this. At that festival, John Gobi, who's like taking classes at UCB and done comedy stuff in New York.
Yeah, he did.
Homicide star with of that festival.
Okay.
He went to Wesleyan and we
super funny.
Gabrus
dude.
And I called him Little Rivers Cuomo. I don't know if we even knew his name, but he was like super funny and he was like the star of that.
Yeah.
And at this one house party, he was being picked on by these like big like bro-y dudes.
Oh no.
And me and Gabrus stopped it.
Yeah.
And that
yeah!
was like our moment of redemption as jacked improvisers. Yeah.
Yeah. You like joined the Justice League.
Yeah, it was great.
We will save you, Hawkeye.
Yeah, and that was the end of it. No one talked to us after that.
But you saw
by the way, you've
people.
Made, we've been doing this podcast for 5 minutes. You've made 700 comic book references.
Well, most of them before we started recording.
That's true. Yeah, so I took a workshop with Brian Husky, and I loved it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, that's what I want to do. I think before I did that workshop, I think I was thinking about going to Chicago because I knew more about that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then I was like, no, well, I think I want to go to New York. And I saw Gabrus was, or not Gabrus, Gethard also did that show. And Eli Newell was there.
I feel like Wengert did a lot of those.
I don't remember if Wengert was there or not.
Mm-hmm.
It was also back when Turco used to do sketches in the beginning of their show.
Right.
And then we moved to improv, which is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably like a Second City inspired thing.
Right.
I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I wasn't involved.
So
I don't give a crap.
You came here, you started taking classes, and you were on an indie team called Big Tobacco, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. One more brief word about Skidmore, because I think that's an interesting sort of history thing.
Yeah,
that is
ahead.
A way in for a lot of people, right? I didn't like the Derek guys.
That's yeah. I met Donald Glover my freshman year. I met Fran my freshman year.
Yeah.
DC and Dom.
They would do Skidmore, and am I right? Am I right that like, boy, I'm gonna get this wrong. But didn't like Paul Briganti get into it because of Skidmore? I feel like people would see it at Skidmore.
I met T.J. Miller at Skidmore.
Yeah.
T.J. Miller was another star of Skidmore, like the most confident man in the world.
And yeah.
Like he owned Skidmore.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so I just wanted, I think that's, if you're like an improv history nerd, there definitely was a few generations of people in the mid-2000s who discovered improv in general and UCB in particular through that festival.
Yeah, for sure.
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
So I signed up for an intensive maybe the next week after that workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you could do intensives. I took a 101, 201, and a 301 in consecutive weeks. So
yeah.
I did it in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
101, 201, 301.
Right.
And I signed up not knowing like where I was going to move to in New York. I didn't have a place to stay. I was just like, I'm going to just do it, and then I have to do it.
Okay.
And it worked out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where did you end up staying? Like the YMCA?
Like a girl I sort of know's like friend who had sort of had an apartment because her mom was going through a divorce, something like that.
So now here's the thing. You seem to me to be a very like mild-mannered and soft-spoken person, but when you're off mic and getting shit done, are you just the pushiest dude around? Like, do you just like get on the phone? Not pushy, but do you just like... Do you just boldly ask for stuff?
I think that was one where it was like in the early days of Facebook. I even just wrote something on Facebook and someone said, oh, I think I have a lead for you.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not that pushy ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just technology helped.
It just
you.
Worked out. Yeah.
Yeah. Meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
3 weeks you did the first.
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it to.
No, we don't let
students.
People do yeah. intensives in 301 because too many people would rush through.
And even, yeah, 201 is like nuts for.
And 201, we stopped doing them in 1 week. We made that yeah. 2 weeks. And then 301, we just stopped. I mean, sometimes it would work out fine.
Right.
But there was too many classes where the teachers are like, they're not even close right. to where they should be.
At the
be.
End of the week, no one in my class understood game.
Well, mm-hmm. even that, even less than that, like just nobody knew how to like play make-believe in like a way right. that resembled reality.
Yeah.
Right.
Did you find yourself also not really getting it, not really understanding it?
It was
frustrated?
A weird thing where I think because I had been doing improv in college, mainly short form, and we would try to do long form, I had like absorbed enough from performing a lot through college that I would do scenes where the teacher would be like, oh yeah, that had a game. So I did it more than other people did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then they'd be asking me, how do you do it? And I'd be like, I don't know.
But don't right. you agree that as a teacher, it's not realistic for anybody to get game at the end of 301?
So. I don't think
I mean,
it's
I don't
realistic
think I got it until I was on Herald Team, Herald Night for a year.
Like, I don't think I got it until last weekend.
Yeah, like to really feel confident about it is a long time.
I don't think
time.
Like feel confident about it, but I think like at the end of 201, if you asked one of them to like say what game is, they wouldn't have been able to do that. And I think we're much better with that now.
Well, you're the king of teaching 201, so we'll get to that in a little bit.
Yeah, I do think our like verbiage and the nuance with which we teach this stuff has improved greatly over the years. You know,
yeah, I
think
that's
our way
true.
Of communicating it effectively, even probably from the time when you were in classes,
for
I
sure.
think has
definitely.
Been honed and refined. It's still hard as shit to get.
It's constantly right. evolving, for sure. Yeah. But yeah, we've gotten a more specific handle on it than we used mm-hmm. to.
Yeah, it feels to me less... like it's coming from at least a place of mystery where people are sort of speaking about game in sort of really vague terms mm-hmm. and that everyone has a super different way of describing it. I think we're more on the same page with how we describe it now than 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I'm very foggy when we talk about that because I can see it always. I mm-hmm. feel like from the student's perspective, it still feels
Is
like
it?
Everybody says it a different way. And it's a little bit different from class. I just think we know that it used to be even more
right,
all over the place. So we're
right.
coming from the point of view, it's like it's way right. more in focus than it used to be.
Right.
But just because it's so hard to get a grasp around improv, that the students would not feel that it is that,
that
focused, I think.
Well, I mean, I don't mind skipping around here unless you have.
All right, no,
like
let's do it. We should probably
specific
flow.
Like
no,
never have a plan. What that makes me think of is like
much like the vision.
What do you? You know, you're a great teacher. You know, you taught
Thank
a lot of people.
You.
People regard you as a great teacher, and you also are like very good at game, at generating game, and
sure.
you know, initiating.
You're a robot, isn't that right?
Yeah,
you're
yeah,
a machine.
That's the, that was my
80% robot.
Show us your circuitry. mm-hmm. So, what to you like? What? How do you communicate that to people, or what do you think is important for people in getting game? And
in getting
it?
Game?
Yeah.
That's a good question. It is one of those things with game where I feel like the people that I've taught that are best at it came into my 201 and were pretty good at it to begin with. Mm-hmm. I do think it's one of those things that's hard to teach. And so I think one thing for people who come in and are a little bit more vague about it, I think one thing just having them have a solid idea of sort of the definition of game. And I'll go with the sort of curriculum definition of pattern of behavior that stems from a first unusual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think a big part of it, and I'm working on this, trying to get the curriculum for that 410 class together.
Yeah, which is a 4-week focus on game.
Is just having people get in the habit of like knowing why their scene is funny. Mm-hmm. Just try to break it down into like the most simplest terms. It's like, why is your first beat funny? Your second beat should be funny for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
So it's trying to make it simple.
Yeah. And how, like, you know, like you said, it's like it's a pattern of behavior that stems from the first unusual thing, which mm-hmm. is what we teach. And like, I feel like a lot of people have difficulty even like establishing the usual things, you
right.
know, establishing what the real thing is. So do right. you have things that you do to help people get that? Or what does that look like to you? What do you think about?
I think that's for sure the hardest thing, and why the first half of the 2-1 curriculum, for the most part, is lots of exercises and scene work, just trying to get people to start with some sort of baseline reality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's your advice? It's kind of overlaps a little bit
yeah.
with what we just asked, John. So, Gardner, what's your advice just for teaching it? How do you teach 201 the best? Like, you've seen people come through this process. What
right.
I guess I'm going to say, as the dude who hires the teachers and watches teachers, it's really impressive to me. Like, I feel like when I watch you, you are very much, in an impressive way, like, trying to figure out a way to teach it. Like, you're not just – you're paying attention to that particular class, but you're mindful of, like, trying to build a reusable process. You remind me of Ian in this way, who I feel like he believes improv is teachable, and I'm going to figure out how to teach it.
Right.
And I'm going to figure out a way that works for a lot of people, as opposed to, like, what do these 16 people need, you know, which is a slightly different approach. So, and you've done, like, I mean, how many 201s have you taught? Like,
in the
100?
70s, I think.
It's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot. So, like, what's your, you've done it more than probably anybody in New York right now. Right. So what's your advice? How do you teach it?
It's like, I feel like every session of 201, I go in with a little bit, there's a different focus.
Yeah.
So the first session, sort of introducing the idea of game and sort of reemphasizing. I would like them to come away from the first session with maybe a definition. I don't really expect them to memorize it because they're so nervous on the first day they'll forget it. Mm-hmm. But just sort of the idea of, I would like them at the end of the first session to know that you start with a baseline of reality, you look for the first unusual thing, you react to it, you justify it.
So real process oriented, like a real narrowly
like
defined.
By the end, I would like them to have that process in
their
mind.
What are the challenges of teaching that?
What are the challenges of teaching that?
Like, what are the, when you come into the first day, you're like, okay, these are the problems they're going to have, and I'm going to be ready to help them through it.
Right.
What, I mean, I know these are really specific questions you're not necessarily ready for. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
I'm curious about it because I am very much like, I switch up my approach all the time to the detriment of my classes. I'll be like, sometimes I guess it works to the advantage, but like, I'll be like, I don't know. I improv is different to me every time I teach it. I feel like I have trouble with that.
I understand what you mean because I come from a, I think about the same things. Like, I've been trying to think, like, well, there's got to be, like you said, a process, like a checklist of, like, first you do this, then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then you have a game, and so, you do it. So, like, but then sometimes I'm like, fuck it, that doesn't work.
I'll lead the witness. So, Gardner, don't you find that if you have that narrow a process that it completely alienates some people and takes the, and puts them in their head and they can't even, like, remember their own name?
I think it's sort of, I think it's something where if they have that structure where they know these steps are going to be followed every single time, they don't necessarily need to be conscious of it. My main thing is that by the end of it, it doesn't seem, almost like what I said before, mysterious. That, like, and I think a big part of something I've been trying to do more teaching in maybe the last year is when someone is in a scene, making sure that the rest of the class is involved by sort of asking them questions about it.
Uh-huh.
And I think a good thing to ask them basically is, well, why did you think that scene was funny? But you can also, every scene, or you also if you ever, sometimes I've assigned people watching a sketch as homework when they're working on game.
Okay.
And basically every single scene, improvised or written, you can go through those steps of, this is the baseline reality. And they might set the baseline reality and have the first line in the same line of dialogue.
Sure.
But they always have both. And there's always an example of, if this is true, then what else is true? And there's either a justification, or sometimes the justification in the sketch is some, like, truth that we recognize that doesn't need to be justified.
Mm-hmm.
But sort of just by showing them that that applies to everything they'll always do.
What that sounds to me like is you're making it so narrow in a way to take the pressure off of them. It's like, I only want you to do these steps. There may be other ways to approach improv. There may be scenes that don't exactly fit this definition as cleanly. Right. But in order to simplify it, I want you just to think about these steps. Like, follow this program that I am teaching you.
Yeah, and I think there's also something to it where it helps in terms of side coaching if they know those steps. Where when I side coach, I don't have to give them the next move, but I can just give them the next step. It's like, well, you haven't justified yet. Or have you reacted to it?
Okay.
Or we haven't gotten if this is true, then what else is true.
That's your first session.
First session is sort of introducing those things.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
It is
a lot. But it's good. Yeah. I think that's the way I would like that. I've certainly, my experience in taking classes, it was much more foggy.
Right.
Sure. Yeah, it was a lot looser. A lot foggier. And I think, like, this is part of the issue that we come up against is, like, what you were saying before about how, like, people, like, talk about things in different ways and have different definitions for things. Like, I think about this when I'm coaching improv groups is, like, I try to coach them in a way where there's, like, this process of, like, remember to do this stuff every time. But I'm aware of the fact that I'm bumping up against, well, like, some of their one person's teacher is telling them this, one person's teacher
right.
Their coach and their other indie group is telling
them
this.
Yeah, and they read some book that said this, and it's hard. I sound like I'm arguing you. I don't mean to. Like,
no,
I actually think the way you're doing it is that's the way to teach anything. you can't teach everything at once. You teach like a way to do it, and once they learn that, then we can go on to different ways that it feels comfortable for them. I've come around as a UCB dude or whatever. I've gone through phases of sort of apologizing for the UCB's tendency to try to solve improv.
Right.
And like assign these very strict terms. I've gone through phases like, no man, we gotta be open to other stuff, man. But now I've come away from that. I was like, no, if you're gonna teach something, be specific.
Yeah. Right.
Teach a particular plan, and there'll be time later to explore other things. Well, doesn't even mean that other things are wrong. It just means like we are learning this right now.
I think the other half of it that's important, we've talked about it before too, is I think the times when they really learn it, where they start to get it in their bones, is just from doing scenes that work.
Yeah, right? The class laughing is what convinces them that it works.
Where they can have a successful scene.
And nothing makes you feel better than just it being funny.
And so how do you go ahead.
Sorry.
How do you do that with a class that is maybe struggling or like maybe they're not getting
it? Definitely harder with a class that's struggling. It always, even to have like one sort of all-star who for whatever reason is in your class makes it much better because you sort of learn by her or his example. But in a class that isn't struggling, it's like I think like side coaching in 201 is good and really necessary. Especially
like you need to justify. Yeah. React to that.
Especially if they've missed things like it's almost always the problem why a scene doesn't work in 201 is one, they're not acting like real people. And that's like a note you can say really quickly and try to get them to adjust. And that usually also covers they almost never have a scene where there's not an unusual thing. It's rare that people are improvising and don't have that, I find. And if they're not, you can maybe give them the choice to yes and a little bit more specifically. But it's usually just stopping them for a second and either be like, was that unusual to you? And if it wasn't unusual to them, let them keep going. But if it was, just be like, well, make sure that you have a reaction to that. Well, how would you react in real life if that happened? And usually just by side coaching just those two notes, their scenes are more often successful.
Yeah, those two notes were, what would you really say?
Yeah, act like a real person. It's all, I guess, goes back
to the note.
What's
the other note?
Act like a real person, and if you thought they missed something specifically unusual, just being like, was that unusual thing?
Okay, yeah.
React to that.
Right, react to that.
At what point did you feel like, you talked about in your workshops kind of struggling with it, or being able to do it but not really knowing how to explain it. At what point did you feel like, oh, I get this? Like, I feel what this is now.
I don't feel like I really felt in my bones like I understood game or could play it without being too in my head about it till I'd probably been on a Herald team like a year, I think was when I started to feel more comfortable with it.
And Bastion had a lot of logic bots.
Yeah, and I think I was playing game. I don't think I had gotten to a point where I was playing it really comfortably or in a way that felt like sort of fluid.
Up until that point, how were you approaching it? Like, you do Herald Night, you get a suggestion, you do the opening, you'd step out for a scene, like what...
It was
what
definitely was one, especially in like advanced classes and in the beginning of Herald Night, I was definitely one of those players who felt most comfortable if I was the person who like saw the premise in the opening, initiated with that premise, and made that game happen.
You were that guy.
I could do that.
Yeah.
So a lot of me...
Let's talk about your 401, because I think this is the time where that maybe you got... Did you have Gethard for 401?
Yeah, I had a really great 401 with Gethard.
Who was in that? Was Clements in that class?
Clements was in that class.
I think like this was one of these like super classes.
It was, and yeah, retrospect, there's a lot of really, really great people.
So yeah, Chris Gethard teaching at a time when he was teaching a lot. So you got a very like primed up, oiled Gethard.
Yeah.
You're in the class. Sean Clements, who's like a hilarious dude and just like a super game machine, real smart. Foss, who can like do anything. You know, play physical, play character, play premise, I think.
And those guys were all great in that class, but also Greg Samothrakis was in that class. Or
who?
Greg DeSantis. Greg Samothrakis I went to college with. Greg DeSantis was
He's
in
jacked.
That class.
He's somewhere real working out.
And
yeah, Greg DeSantis is like a hilarious,
he was
like
the best
understated
of all of us in that 401. He was effortlessly great in every scene he was always in.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe Greg DeSantis. It's just effortless. And like you look
He's
at
one of those dudes
like,
that would take 3 seconds, then say 4 words, and the room explodes with laughter.
Yeah, and you look at him and you're like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
You know?
Isn't he like living with his wife in New Haven and just eating raw food or something?
I think so, yeah.
Didn't he eat for a year, he only ate food that he grew?
I don't know about
that. I think that's
he had a
true.
Blog like that, yeah.
Huh.
For a couple months at least. Mm-hmm. That kind of dude.
But he was amazing, yeah. Yeah, and that's a class of, like, even with Brian and Sean, Greg was, like, the one everyone was like, Greg is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But didn't you were talking about like getting game in your bones and stuff like that. And, you were talking about how you were the kind of person who felt comfortable leading the premise.
I felt most comfortable with that. And also, we were talking about Christina Gaussis earlier with Cypher's taking her class.
Yeah.
She was. I took Gethard's class and I took some advanced classes, but I don't. For some reason, I feel like even game clicked more after I'd taken a couple of Gauss's classes.
Who doesn't teach that?
Who doesn't teach game? And for me, it was so good to have two classes where we didn't talk about game.
She's one of the best teachers ever. Mm-hmm. The way she performs, she's kind of performing as she teaches in a way that is sort of inspiring.
And she, more than most teachers, or is a great example of everything that she teaches. If you ever see her perform, she does exactly that.
Yes. That's completely true.
Yeah.
She practices what she preaches for sure.
What was, you brought up this 401 class, like what was so great about that 401 class?
Might be Myas. I don't mean to put words in your mouth.
What led you to bring that up, Will?
I just feel like the people in that class, I've heard them all independently mention that 401 and that they kind of stayed linked to each other. Mm. Even if they weren't all on the same teams, I associate like Clemens Foss and Brent. I feel like a generation without knowing it kind of got defined at that time.
Right.
Not that all the 401s around that time were like a whole level of, and also that was the birth of the indie movement, came out of that level of people.
Right.
Like indie teams that, I mean, there's exceptions to this, but like Big Tobacco was like one of the teams that like, we're going to do this all the time. We're going to make a team and perform a lot.
We're going to try to fill up under St. Mark's.
Yeah. Yeah. You did.
Mm-hmm.
Was Kid Durbin before or after Big Tobacco?
They were the same generation. They maybe were a little earlier than us.
Chelsea was on Kid Durbin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like those teams, I just remember noting, like before, indie teams were something that you did like once every 2 months.
Right.
While you were waiting for like another class. But then these guys were like making it their own world. I forget where Thank You Robot fell into this, but.
That was like a little after us. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we were really into it and really tried to have consistent coaches. Shannon O'Neill coaches for a long time.
Indie teams that treated it like a real team, I guess that's what I'm saying. Phil Schorber, was he a Big Tobacco guy?
Phil Schorber was, yeah. Hal Phillips sort of organized it. He was not in that 401, but he was like, Hal like went to our class show, saw everyone, he thought he was good. And
he recruited from other class shows. He was insane.
it worked out. It was like, he nailed it, yeah.
Hal also read all Marvel comics in order of publication, I think, from 1942, talking about like obsessives like Greg DeSantis. I'm friends with Hal, so I feel like it's okay that I can publicly say he's an obsessive completist and sometimes crazy in an impressive way. So it makes sense to me that he like was obsessive about getting indie teams together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Sherpa, his team was together forever. I guess technically they're still together.
Yeah.
What else? So, yeah, and so we mentioned Bastion. Bastion was like a powerhouse Harold team for a while.
Yeah, and Bastion was one of those teams for people who weren't around in that generation that I think a lot of people were sort of, especially maybe like an older generation people, I feel were sort of almost annoyed by us because we were like sort of very lovey-dovey. We were one of those Harold teams.
Yes, you were the doing it right team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were all placed on
practice
it. It was all
twice
of our first teams. Mm-hmm. We practiced twice a week for a lot of it. We were like sort of a very clean-cut team.
You
we
looked like
tall.
The goddamn fresh-faced, best and brightest Stepford Wives team. Like you were manufactured
exactly like
by his improv teacher.
Yeah.
You looked like that.
Yeah, I think our average height was like 6'1".
An amazingly tall and thin team.
Yeah, because it was like, it was you,
Frucci,
Maggie Carey.
Maggie Carey, Brian Barrett, Oscar, how do you say Oscar's last name? Maggie Yenis.
Molly Lloyd.
John Murray.
And John Murray averaging the height down.
Yeah. John and Molly brought it down.
Lydia.
Oh, yeah, Lydia. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Lydia's a tall drink of water. We got just a bunch of stocks on that team. I remember
huge.
First show you guys walked out, it was hilarious. Like, I think people laughed. Like, the team was like, whoa, it's like a basketball team. Just walked out on Harold.
The Harlem Globetrotters crashed their plane on our
island. I didn't know. Like, I knew Maggie and John, I think, were the only people I knew on that team. And I think I'd seen a Molly in one show.
Mm-hmm.
But you, I'd never heard of. Mm-hmm. Frucci, Barrett, I'd never seen. Oscar. Oh, and Lydia, I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on that first team, that was like a team where I don't think I was in one of the first beats for a few months. I was like a little too hesitant, I think.
That's right. You did the first group game.
Games with like the most laid out premise I could think of. That was my thing.
You were then the first. I remember the show. You were the first group game.
Mm-hmm.
The first scene was John Murray and Lydia. That was the first scene of the first Bastion show.
They were sort of the most brave to just.
And then Molly and. I forget who was in the second scene. I don't remember after that. Mm-hmm. I'm losing track.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. Oscar was in the second group game, and he was a group game was all these Santa Clauses were showing up. Mm-hmm. It was a bar at the North Pole, and all these Santa Clauses showed up, and they were all talking about Christmas. And Oscar was the bartender, and it's half of the scene, like, one Santa Claus goes, ah, these toys. And Oscar goes, hey, we don't want any trouble here. And, like, established that these Santa Clauses always get into fights or something like that. It was funny. I mean, like, this enormously tall team is pretty funny, is what I said to myself.
What I mean, we've had other Bastion members on here before.
I don't think we've – don't we ban them? Out of, like, our hatred towards their fresh-faced, clean-cutness?
That's right. That's right. But I want to ask you this. Like, what do you think made Bastion such a great team? And what made you so, like – what made you so close, as you talked about?
I think Gethard was our first coach, and he was a really good coach for not just the kind of the X's and O's of improv, but for sort of the like psychology of improv and as far as like a team thing. And he was always like so like intense about it that I think we like really bought into this idea of like we're a team, we're a family, we got to take care of each other. He was big on the idea of if you ever have like an issue with something, it stays here. Don't talk to anyone about disliking the team. And we sort of just bought into it. We hung out a lot outside of shows and rehearsals. We, up until like last year, continued to have Bastion Secret Santa Christmas parties. Our team had been disbanded for years. We continued to do that. And barbecues and, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Brian Barrett, when he got married, used part of the 101 curriculum in his wedding vows.
Which was strangely beautiful, yeah.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. About like supporting your partner and like playing the top of your intelligence. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really good.
I heard that. I was like... fucking Bastion. it's great though.
It's also proof that we're a cult.
Well, yeah,
for sure.
Are we hiding that? I'm putting that in the literature now. Come get brainwashed.
I would also say for what I think made Bastion work, I think there's for whatever reason, sometimes teams are put together that their personalities and playing styles fit really well together. And I think that was like a team that fit really well, especially for me. Like, I feel like if I had not been lucky enough to been put on Bastion, there's some teams where I would have possibly like gotten buried and then gotten off Herald Night.
Yeah.
That was a team that was so supportive and had such a good mix of what people are good at that
it
I was
did.
Able to
it
do
was,
well.
It was
in
really it. Impressive. There were some who were like actors first, some were premise right. first, some mm-hmm. were kind of like Frucci was like, I mean, I love Frucci, and I also love making fun of him.
Yeah.
But I think he was like a big just kind of like, what? No. Like yeah, his right. skeptical kind of nature. Yeah. But it was necessary, and it grounded right. stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you have a team of people like who are working that hard, you need someone like Adam Frucci who does the bare minimum of work on stage.
That's true. He definitely he had no hesitation to call bullshit the moment
sure.
he saw it.
Yeah.
As it was being
That's
formed.
One of the best things about him. That's one of the
He's
most
hilarious.
Fun things about mm-hmm. it.
But then, like, you know, like, I felt like John Murray came from more at that time of a kind of like acting, you know, one
yeah, super physical
place.
And yeah,
so
characters.
Like those two were hilarious yeah. together. What are you doing? Why? Yeah, fun team. And you guys were together forever. Didn't you do more Heralds than like anybody? Because you
we
guys were always
time.
The anchor team.
We
so
had
like you-
a good run where we got to be the anchor team. And then it ended up, I was only on it for 2.5 years, but I think they stayed together another like year and a half or 2 years.
Yeah. Bastion right. was like a little bit overlooked though, because you weren't like you weren't rock stars the
right.
way some teams were. You
we
were like the
like
dependable
the or the
right.
85. Yeah.
There was, you weren't like a sexy team improv wise for whatever reason.
Yeah. It took like a very particular kind of improv student for us to be their favorite team.
Yeah.
Just like yeah. very consistent.
Yeah.
Games. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing. I think, like, you can tell me if I'm inaccurately categorizing or unfairly categorizing you, but I feel like that's what Bastion was like this really great, solid, specific, consistent team mm-hmm. that maybe wasn't doing anything that was like hugely innovative or like flashy
right.
per se, other than, I mean, your biggest innovation was like consistently playing games.
Although
and doing good
you're
shows.
Totally right, but I think that they went through, they recognized that and then consciously mixed it up a lot.
You know what? I'm forgetting about that. You're right.
They
yeah.
really, they were like, okay, we're not going to be the like rule team anymore. We're going to
yeah.
do organic openings.
Right.
We're going to mix it up.
You're
going to throw ourselves.
Right.
We're going to.
We got really into thematic heralds. I think we were more than at least the Herald teams that I know, and I feel like a lot more teams do it now. We were like the first team that I remember, like really every show trying to be like, how is this show going to be thematic? Mm-hmm. And I think we were pushed by it a lot because we would get notes. We would get emails from Anthony, like team assessment notes that was basically like, everything's great, but you could be better. Take more risks. And it was always a hard note to go into with the coach and be like, I guess we need to be braver. Mm-hmm. But eventually we kind of focused it on trying to have heralds that were either more organic or thematic.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think, like how did you tackle that thematic herald thing? Like what do you think works?
It sort of depended on what coach we were working on. We did a lot of with Wenger early on, and we did some sort of different kind of thematic stuff with Gethard later on. He kind of came back to coach us. Mm-hmm. With Wenger, how we sort of worked on it, I think I remember, is that he would sort of guide us in the beginning by almost giving us how it was going to be thematic, and we would just do that and see what it felt like. Mm-hmm. Like he would give us the suggestion, like a leading suggestion, like Bible, and be like, well, what's the Bible Herald? Mm-hmm. But we would have to figure out, well, how does the Bible Herald get edited, or what is a group game in a Bible Herald, or how should third beats go in a Bible Herald? Is it like a book of the Bible or whatever the thing would be?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is a good way to like approach it, is like with those leading suggestions of like try to do this really easy one, and then when you get good at that, do the like blue herald.
My favorite thematic herald I think that we did, we got the suggestion timetable, mm-hmm. and it became a herald where our scenes were on a like predetermined schedule. So you would go in, there would be a stage manager that would come in and it's like the scene needs to go on for 40 more seconds. or it's like you've only got 5 more seconds left in the scene.
Oh, wow.
And then at some point you met Brian Barrett, played this character. He was playing this like alpha male agent character called Saul Murray. And at some point, the stage manager, I think I came in to be like, oh, we only have 10 seconds left to the scene. And he sort of just yelled at me, and he's like, this scene will go on as long as it needs to. And it became a thing in the Herald that, like, Saul Murray did not have to obey the rules of the Herald. And that was great.
Oh, yeah, and so then you got moved to Reuben Williams.
Right.
You got promoted to Reuben Williams. Mm-hmm. And did that change your, like, the way that you played at all, or?
A little bit. I think when I first got put on Reuben, it was right when, like, Wenger had just left and Charlie Sanders had just left and I think Eugene had just left. Mm-hmm. And I got put on with Kevin Hines. And I think part of me, like, sort of in the back of my mind was like, well, I think they need, like, a Wenger-type person.
Uh-huh.
Mm. And I sort of, at a certain point, I was just like, well, I can't be that. I can't do what Joe does.
Yeah.
So I had to sort of figure out back, it's like, well, what is my style and how do I bring that to the team rather than try to play a certain way?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's smart observation because what they probably wanted was you.
Right, yeah. They didn't pick me to be a new Joe and I couldn't do that.
Right,
so, yeah.
Very few people can do what Joe does.
Any of those guys. Those are all very specific individuals.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that was really crazy about it was, or getting on Reuben, was because I came to New York with very specific improv goals, and I think a lot of people do UCB because they want to be in TV shows or movies or write, and they see that as a step towards it. And I didn't have any of those goals. I didn't even think about it. Mm-hmm. I had no ambition for those things. I just wanted to be on a Herald team. And then I guess when I got on a Herald team, I was like, well, I would love to, I guess, do Turco was the next thing. I was like, really? It's like, I really want to do that. And when I got those things, I got Herald team and got Turco and started teaching and then got Reuben. I think Reuben was the last one I think that I had got. And I sort of went through this like crisis of almost being depressed where I was like, well, I don't know what to do with my life now.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you handle that?
Hit the gym, I bet.
Yeah, just went, it's like, what worked for me in the past? Deadlifts. Let's get back to it. It was a lot of me just figuring it out. I think in me sort of feeling like I should have some sort of thing I was working on outside of UCB so that I didn't feel just like I was focusing everything on UCB. And so I think at that point, as I started getting more into theater, I'd studied theater in college, but really only because it seemed the closest thing to studying improv. But then I started trying to go see more theater and read more plays and started trying to write plays.
Mm-hmm. Which you've been doing, right?
Like, yeah, I have been. I feel like right now I'm not doing as much as I was, but I'm still interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nope.
Okay.
Well, I'm curious. So, like, how into that? You're into that a lot now, right?
A little bit, yeah. Right now, I'm trying to write a sketch show, so I'm less into the writing plays thing. But I still try to read plays and see plays.
I just feel like there's like a little faction of UCB performers where that happens. Like Zach Woods sees a ton of plays, you know, consciously studies acting. Tanoy sees like a million plays. I mean, definitely what I think is interesting about that is we do stuff on stage, but we are mostly informed outside of real life by TV and movies where the mediums do not translate so well.
Yeah.
But if you go watch a play, like that stuff translates. Like soliloquies, monologues, coming up stage, going backstage.
Yeah.
Like if you watch a play, you learn what mechanics are available to you as a dude on the stage.
Yeah, it's something that I've been thinking about, like trying to figure out how to get our performers, if not performers and students, to go see plays more, like figuring out like...
I mean, we live in a city where there's a ton of great ones.
But they're so... I mean, up until a couple of months ago when I joined the Theater Development Fund, which, by the way, I think like anybody who's a performer at this theater can join.
Okay. Note taken.
TDF.org, you get discounts on plays. And if you're not... I wasn't going to plays for a while because they're so fucking expensive.
Yeah.
You know, and I think like this is the... You're absolutely right. Like people's stage presence, for the most part, is informed by either television, movies, or each other's stage.
You look at people who write their sketches. Everybody's sketch is about a television show, or it's a parody of a television show. SNL is about TV. I mean, it makes sense that SNL parodies TV. It's a TV show. National Lampoon used to parody magazines. Like you should, you have to parody the medium you're in,
right?
Because that's what's available to you. We don't. I mean, like Jeff Hiller and Amy Hite. Did a sketch show where the last one they do little parodies of all these great plays. Like
it was awesome.
Death of a Salesman and I can't remember any of them now. Shakespeare, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah, as they're poisoning each other.
Yeah, but I think it works because this is a staged sketch.
Right.
Same thing with 2017 Tony Awards. Stephanie Streisand and
You're using on stage to do stage stuff.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say. Well, I think the big thing with sketch and improv too is ideally you're drawing more from real life, and I don't know if we always do that enough.
Right.
And as far as like pulling things from plays, I don't know if it's like one thing with like if anything that is referencing a play is there are so few people that go see plays that doesn't hit as hard as like references to TV and movies because your audience has seen those. But I do think there's technique and stylistic things that you can borrow that they might not even recognize from plays but are effective.
Right.
And I think that's interesting.
That's what I think it is. It's just the stage presence and the sort of technique of being on a stage and a live audience in front of people. You know, even if it's just learning how to project to the back of the house, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you found that that reading plays and going to see plays has affected the way that you improvise or the way that you teach improvisation?
It definitely. Well, I've taught twice a class called the improvised play class,
which is now like a running show at a
theater. The first
center.
Class kind of branched off and now does it as a running show, and that was definitely influenced by me at the time being really obsessed with watching plays and seeing plays, and I think also with the idea that for the most part at UCB. And there's an interview where Ian Roberts talks a lot about this. What we're doing is we're improvising sketches, and that's very much the style.
Yeah.
But I don't think improv necessarily has to be that because there's lots of kinds of theater, right? And there's lots of kinds of theater that make us laugh, and it's not always sketches.
Yeah.
So it's sort of the idea of how do we tackle something, and monoscenes even do this.
Monoscenes work so well because they only use the conventions that exist in a normal play. There's no tag out. There's nothing that was invented just for improv. You watch a monoscene, if you've never seen improv before, it makes sense.
Right.
It's like, oh, this is a play. I know what this is.
Right.
Even if somebody's playing multiple characters, that happens in plays.
Yeah.
Like, people can get that. Sorry.
There's something to, I think, plays that are funny, and not all plays are funny. A lot of comedy on stage is really terrible.
I would have seen Macbeth, and it just is not funny.
Yeah, that play didn't work.
Yeah, it's not funny. Everyone gets killed. It's stupid.
But I think there is something to plays when they are funny, or even show like sitcoms where they jokes play out, that there's something that when you get to know a character a little bit better and have that develop, then there can be more kind of subtle character games that you can't always get with sketches because you've known that character 20 seconds.
Yeah.
that you can get a little bit in monoscene sometimes.
Have you written plays?
I've written like short plays. I did one play at UCB. It was like a 60-minute play.
Which one? The
Assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, yeah. Congrats.
Yeah.
Thanks. It was fun.
It was fun. It was a good show.
Thanks.
And you wrote a short play besides that one? Can I ask what it was about?
The play that was with... Well, I have a ton of plays that are like either 10 minutes to 30 minutes. I have like a...
Your improv must inform that a lot, right?
For sure. For me, writing plays felt much more like improvising than writing sketches felt to me. Writing sketches felt a little bit more mathematical as far as like coming in with what the idea is and trying to beat it out.
Yeah.
Whereas plays, you really can just start typing as that character and then be like, well, how do I want to respond to that? And I feel like I surprise myself more writing plays and dialogue, like I'm able to do improvising, than I do normally writing sketches.
Yeah.
Can I ask what any of your plays are about?
They're about a lot. Well, I'll tell you this, which is, I'll say the play that people like the most is this play I wrote for a playwriting class. It's only like 12 minutes long, but it's this couple like going through a separation and sort of arguing about one of them has a kid and he's staying with his dad's for the first time, and they're sort of arguing because the mom is hiding the kid's favorite book and the dad needs it to read to the kid. And it's a play that people really like it, and interestingly, it's like my parents like are not divorced. I have no life experience with that. But that's the play that people, especially people who have been gone through separations and stuff, that's the one that people say feels the realest to them.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right, let's cut through this bullshit.
Great.
Again?
Yeah.
Too much bullshit.
I want to talk about you got something?
No. Go ahead.
Well, I want to go back to the Gauss's class, because yep. I see you as very like analytical, both just in your approach to things in general. You get a goal, you go after it.
Right.
And in a way that impresses and intimidates me.
Okay.
But I feel like you have an appreciation for the other side. Like, you mm-hmm. are adventurous in a way. So you're Joey game, but mm-hmm. you learned a lot from a non-game teacher.
For sure.
How did you break through? How did you change from a dude that felt only comfortable initiating premise? What happened?
Well, I think part of it was, in the classes before, because I knew, oh, the scene needs to have a game, I would only feel comfortable, or I'd feel more comfortable if I was the one starting it and was like, oh, I know that this is a game. Uh-huh. And I'll present it in a way that's so clear that they can't miss it. And then mm-hmm. I will be able to go, if this is true, then what else is true, even if they can't.
Right, okay.
And then I think in the Gauss's class, because she never asked about game, I never worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sort of freed me up to just have scenes that felt like I was listening a lot more than I normally was and being affected by the other person and making choices that felt just sort of simple and honest. Mm-hmm. Which I think people, like, the idea with game is that hopefully you're doing both. But I had not been able to really put those together until I focused on just the one side of it with Gauss's for a while.
Let's talk about other places where you might have learned stuff as a performer. What did you learn doing Turco that maybe you didn't learn doing other shows?
What I learned in Turco is fairly similar to doing like weekend team shows, as far as like performing for people who aren't really familiar with improv and want it to be really fast and funny.
Yeah.
And get right to what the idea is. They don't applaud like smart moves.
Yeah.
There's something to it that I think is good for anything where that idea of show don't tell, I think, is even bigger with those audiences. Like, they want to see the funny thing happen.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a good instinct to be like, well, how do I get there as fast as I can? And
tell the story about that woman who gave you the suggestion and like the thing I've asked you about a couple times. Yeah.
Okay. So, and I told this on the Turco podcast too, so it's a cross reference. But I was doing a show in Nashville with Turco, and at like 4 a.m, Brandon Scott Jones and I were in this like fried chicken place
uh-huh.
in some area of the town that we were not supposed to be in,
right.
According to our driver, who couldn't believe we were there.
Okay.
It was a place that had won a Steve Harvey hoodie award.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what that is, but
right.
It had won it.
Yeah.
And we were the only white people in it, except for either the owner or the security guard, who was this big fat guy with a gun in his belt.
Jesus.
But we're in line, and there's this couple before us or behind us. And they recognized that we were not regulars.
Yes.
And sort of asked what we were doing there. And we said we were doing comedy. And then they asked us to tell a joke, which is kind of that standard thing that improvisers get asked a lot. And so we try to explain what we do. And then
this is Bastion coming out. It's like, well, we'll sell them on the idea of long form improv.
Brandon Scott Jones is like this super sweet guy.
Yeah.
So she wanted to see a scene. And so we're like, all right, well, give us a suggestion. And she took a long time to think about it. And then she goes, in this sort of like sweet voice, she goes, a man fucking a woman real, real good. And so we took that suggestion and we did a scene in line at this fried chicken place that she really liked. She laughed through the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That woman is Laura Wilcox.
Yeah. She came to New York the next week, started taking classes.
You know, one of the things that, you know, we've done some Torco shows together, and mm-hmm. I think, you know, you're still really great at that, being able to step out and, like, here's a clear premise of the scene that has, like, a pretty strong potential for a game.
Yeah, you kind of have to be able to do that a little bit with Torco. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is initiate with premise.
Yeah.
What'd you learn doing Let's Have a Ball?
It was funny. Let's Have a Ball was my favorite show to watch before I got to do it. It was Gauss's show, and maybe in the same way that, like, that thing of me being like sort of a game head, I loved watching these like 10-minute scenes that didn't necessarily have games, but were like, when it was funny, it was funnier to me than anything else, and mm-hmm. when it wasn't funny, I was super invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
What did I learn? I think playing with some like really good actors and some really dynamic players. Like I played with like Gauss, obviously, and Adzit would do the show, and he was really great to play with because he's so, when you're playing, I think, with a really good actor, it's hard not to try to match it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really great. And then playing with like really dynamic people like Becky Drysdale,
mm-hmm.
who's really fun to watch, and is like, you sort of have to match her energy or you kind of get left behind in the scene. So it kind of mm-hmm. makes it like, well, how do I make a big choice to match her big choice? Or how do I complement what her big choice is? And I think I learned from that.
What do you learn from doing Improv Nerds?
What I learned from doing Improv Nerds? Improv Nerds is a show.
Tell our audience what Improv Nerds is.
So Improv Nerds is a show that Chelsea Clark and I originally started because we were doing some Torco shows together, and that at the time was the only time we got to play with each other. And we wanted to do more of that, and we really sort of connected. And she was someone who came up with me in sort of the same generation, and we were never on the same teams, but we're sort of similarly like got on teams around the same time, and we're both sort of similarly like super nerdy about improv, didn't have any goals outside of it.
Yeah.
So we started doing the show at the Creek, and sort of the premise was that her and I would perform for part of it, but in order to get people to come watch it, we would have a first half that would be something that would hopefully draw an improv nerdy audience. So we would think, well, when we were students, what would we want to have seen?
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of is how the show came along.
Right.
And then eventually we moved to UCB East. And Steve Tice and Phil Jackson joined us, who in the beginning just were students who went to every single improv nerd show.
Yes.
And eventually there was like a competition of which one of them would miss the first improv nerd show, because for months neither of them did. To the point where Phil had a work thing where he was in Toronto, but so that he wouldn't technically miss Improv Nerds, we did a thing where he and Steve did a scene like over their phones, where Phil's like an advertising executive, and he left like a business table to like go to another part of the restaurant to do an improvised scene where he was like a dude calling a Victoria's Secret customer service representative to complain about lingerie he had
Done.
Uh-huh.
And it was amazing.
Yeah.
And eventually we invited them on because we both really liked them and liked how they played and felt like they had the essence of what we're about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you learn doing those shows, though? Like, you do sets now. You, Chelsea, Phil, and Steve will do sets.
I feel like there's something I think anytime you're doing like a smaller group improv, you learn something different than like Curfew, which is right now 7 people, but it's been bigger than that, of just like you have to step out and do something. And we also do much more, we sort of try to model ourselves after Foursquare a little bit, because that's like a show that me and Chelsea are really obsessed with.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to do things like organic edits, and Chelsea and I took a Lutz workshop once, so we try to use whatever we can remember from that as far as like using different parts of the stage really specifically and finding connections that feel organic like that. But a big part of it is, I think, because I'm so comfortable with them and it feels like a very low-pressure show, there's something to... I feel like I play more characters with that show. I feel like I do more silly things in that show because I'm not worried about it hitting necessarily.
Hmm. Is there... So you're, what you're saying is that when you're on... the curfew, do you feel a little bit more like a restriction in that area, or?
I feel like with the curfew, I think it's a similar thing almost with fashion. It's like there's different people who play different ways, and we've sort of gotten roles for ourselves.
Sure.
So I sort of feel like I have a role with the curfew and try to sort of play within that. I can probably break out of it a little bit. And there's also just kind of a pressure of like improv nerds audience. They are like improv nerds for the most part. They are like students. They're super into it. And they're not like people who took, you know, the bus in from Long Island.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
So they will be more patient with me being experimental. It could be the train.
Jersey's the bus.
So I think that's part of it. Thank you, Cypher.
So, yeah, talking about improv nerds, like you're, you know, you get to work with a lot of students. And I think like a lot of students kind of look up to you and kind of look up to you. There's nothing else I was going to say after that.
Right.
But so, like, this is our first podcast that we're doing since the auditions for house teams and everything. And so, you know, there may be a lot of people wondering, like, what should I do if I didn't get a callback or if I didn't get put on a team or, like, what could I do or how should I be, like, what should I be doing now? So do you have any...
Yeah, that's a tough question. Well, one thing that I do want to say is that Bastion was not the first team I auditioned for. I auditioned for Tantrum, and I remember I was as heartbroken as I imagine anyone could be about not getting on a team. Because I'd put... It was the reason...
That was your goal,
The reason I moved to New York. And it was a big thing. It's like, I think we're getting a little bit better at this, but there was a thing sort of where there wasn't a lot of things to let you know if you're doing well at this or not doing well at this. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of signs. So that was like a big sign of like, maybe I shouldn't be doing it. Maybe I'm not. Mm. And sort of the reason why I kept doing it was just that it's like I was too obsessed with it to stop at this point.
Yeah.
So I think there's something to, like, if you really are obsessed with it and love it, don't let an audition make you feel like you're bad at it or keep you from doing it. There's a lot of different places where you can improvise and a lot of places where people are great at it.
How can you find out if you're good? If the audition is something that people accept that validation or they really take to heart that rejection, that seems to carry a tremendous amount of weight, more than any other single thing that happens at this theater. Getting on a team or not affects people's perception of themselves.
Right.
I still have not gone to a Harold Knight.
That's so sad.
So
I walked in once. I walked in. I watched for 5 minutes.
I just want to say real quick, and Saif, I said this to you in an email, like just the fact that you got a callback, I think is like tremendous validation.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
I feel amazing because of all that.
Yeah.
But not getting it was like, ooh.
Sure, sure.
And Saif is not alone in that.
Yeah.
No.
This bitch next
Hundreds
to me,
people,
Keaton, gets on.
Yeah. So I got to keep him off mic, man. Yeah. He's dangerous.
I'm surprised you. I'm surprised you didn't fire him as the intern. So how do you speak to that? Like,
yeah. Well, I think that one answer is just there's never going to be anything that tells you if you're good at this or not. There's not any, like you can take that from it, and I guess that's like an affirmation. But there's been times like recently where I'm like, I'm terrible at this.
Let me push this a little bit further to you because I think you're able to answer these questions. Okay. I know what you're saying. Like I've had as much validation as this theater can give. I still feel like a fraud. I'd say at least once every 5 weeks I walk out of the Step Brothers show going, well, I'm bad at this.
Yep, I did. Yeah.
And fooled everybody just because I was nice to everyone.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm not actually funny and this is fake.
Yeah, right. I've been going through a period of that on Airwolf now where I walk out of shows and I'm like, all right, I'm not good at this anymore.
But when I did get put on a team, I was reassured in a way that I had not been before that.
Right.
That I was good at it.
Right.
And I wonder what other validation is. I'm thinking of this now as a guy who's helping to run the school. Like, there are people I would like to give that validation to.
Right.
And there's some people that I wouldn't. So what is the way that students out there, how do you know if you're good? How do you really know?
Well,
because you knew you were good when you didn't get Tantrum, right? What did you think of yourself?
Yeah, I think I was probably like too cocky, if anything, of being like, what? I remember going to Harold Knight afterwards and like watching Tantrum happen and be like, I'm better than that person. I'm better than that person.
Yeah.
I'm better than that person.
I think that's very relatable.
Mm-hmm.
But
So yeah, how did I guess
how
I
do you really
well
know
enough in classes? Things that I remember being great for my confidence and feeling good about it. One was Five Dudes used to have a regular indie show, which was Gethard and Zach Woods and Bobby Moynihan,
Charlie Sanders
and Eugene. And they were, I love them.
Sure.
And there was a time where a bunch of them were out of town or for some reason couldn't do the show, and it was just going to be Zach and Gethard. And they invited a few people to sort of sit in with them. They were all students. And I got to do that. And that was a huge thing. That was something that was like, I felt a lot more confident being like, oh, that person, I stood out at least enough for that person to ask me to do this show. And it was me, Clements, and Donald Glover.
Yeah.
So different. I'm in the bottom half of the success scale of that, but it still was good for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is like, look to like, you know, if you're doubting whether or not you're good, you're looking for some kind of validation, like what else might be going on?
Maybe not even validation. How do you just get an assessment? I think some people, if there was a way to get a number, 1 right. to 100, how good am I? It'd be a relief to know where you're at.
I think everything, like even when you get class notes, it's everything you're bad at. You know, like you guys kind of don't say the good things.
You don't think in your 401 notes you got like things you were good at?
You do, but I'm saying like when you're a student and you're like trying to absorb and figure out right. if you're good, the bad sticks out a lot more.
I think that's more what it is. The teachers say good things and the students ignore it.
Yeah.
Right.
They're like, that's bullshit. That bad thing is what's true.
Yeah.
Because we've actually all said to each other as teachers, say a good thing and say a positive thing and a negative thing. Mm-hmm. And we've done that. And I read the notes the teachers leave and they've just gotten more watered down and unspecific.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the
students disregard compliments.
Yeah.
Right.
And maybe that is on the teachers for not delivering them in a way that sticks.
I think
I think
not to get too broadly psychological, but I think it's a very human thing that we like hear the bad things and we tend to put the good things aside.
So if there was a number, mm-hmm. even right now, I'd be curious if I could plug myself into a machine and see where I rated 1 to 100. Like I'm actually thinking of what number I would get.
From 1 to 100. It's so subjective. No yeah. Right. And it's also a thing that's like, I think this was a big part of the Gauss's class.
Don't cop
too.
Out. It is somewhat, you could do it somewhat accurately.
I think it depends what kind of style of improv you like.
Cool. I bet you could break it into three different categories. And it could be like acting, playing it real, and emotional commitment.
But what's the point of that?
Game analysis. Do you want to know if you're good or not?
But at the end of the day, shouldn't you just be believing whether you're good or not? Like, you shouldn't need some
kind of system
of validation.
At some point, you gain enough sense of this that you can assess it for yourself. At
some
point.
Teams. That I'm on that I feel I'm not good, and there's other teams that I feel like I'm great.
Sure.
Like, it's a chemistry, a combination
exactly.
of people.
Yeah.
A venue.
Well, all right. Mm-hmm. So,
form.
So the teams where you feel great, okay, or a performance where you felt great, whatever the first time that happened was, whenever that was, whether it was a class show or an indie group or something like that, that was probably huge for your own confidence in yourself. It's probably, it was like a breakthrough moment. Like,
definitely.
Oh, I felt it. I felt that for the first time, what I've seen on stage. Mm-hmm. Like I would have scenes in classes where I felt like, oh, I've broken through to something, even if it was only for that scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that is an example of a validation that you have. Like as a teacher, I think it's your responsibility to try to make those happen sometimes.
Definitely.
When you see it close, because they'll burn into people's sense memory.
I think those are really important things to notice too, is like sometimes I feel good at like I'm good at this, and then some situations I feel like I'm not so good at this, because you at least are noticing like, all right, I'm good at this. There are situations where I am able to do this, because there's some people who like never feel like they're any good at it, you know, and maybe some people who like aren't actually very good at it, but to be able to recognize like, well, I am doing scenes that are getting laughs, I'm making good moves, I'm getting good notes, so I must be good at this in some respect.
What besides an audition is a barometer for students to know if they're good or bad?
Nothing.
No, that's not true. There are some out there.
Feedback from teachers or feedback from peers, I guess. Let me tell you a story. It might be annoying, but at some point in my life, I connected to it.
Okay.
It's not like it's one of those stories, like a made-up story that proves a point or something. So, there's this famous violinist. It sounds like it's going to be a joke. And he's in his dressing room and someone knocks and comes in and is like, hi, I just wanted to talk to you. I'm a huge fan of yours. Oh, thank you so much. Come in. And then the guy, the fan who comes in says, I don't know if you remember this, but 20 years ago, I was a teenager. I came in here. I asked if I could play my violin for you and have you assess if I should keep doing this or not. And he's like, do you remember that? And he's like, not really. And he's like, well, what happened? And he's like, you said I was terrible, that I shouldn't do it anymore. And he's like, oh, what happened? He's like, oh, I stopped playing the violin. I went to business school. I'm a banker. I'm very happy. I have a great family. But I do have this question. It's like, how did you know I was bad, that I shouldn't make a career of this? And the great violinist is like, well, I say that to anybody who plays for me. The ones that are going to be great will keep playing no matter what I say to them. And I think there's something true to that, to improv, yeah. Of like, if you, the people that are great are the people that are obsessed with it and will do it no matter what someone says. And I think are the people who inwardly know that they're good no matter what.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's true. But you're right, and I'm going to discount it anyway and be a bad improviser and not build on it. But like, I think the UCB gives more systematic feedback than any improv school. Like, we have systematic times where the teacher is required to write something and have it be mailed. You have to at 401. And we might be implementing that in all improv and sketch classes very soon. Mm-hmm. But just to the level we have done it, I don't know if the students, it seems to have no effect on the students' assessment of themselves. And I got to say, not quite fair, because I know that students aren't lying, but it makes me resentful a little bit, because they're like, well, tell me how I'm doing. And it's like, no, what you're saying is put me on a team.
Right.
That is the only message that you accept.
Right.
Let me go to actually, that's not true. Put me on a team or don't put me on a team. Those are the two messages that I listen to.
Right.
Anything else you say to me is bullshit. Right. And it's like, that's not true. Every teacher is telling you, teachers are not – people love to give their assessments of everything, and the teachers are assessing you. I can't corrupt the teachers to lie. Like, they're being as mean or as nice as they feel is being honest to their to their own nature. But I don't think the students are lying, obviously. But it's frustrating to me. It's like, well, I don't know how to communicate it to you.
Right.
But it's like, get on stage until they laugh.
Yeah.
Like, then you know.
Right.
And we are communicating it to them. People are having it communicated to them. I think, like, passing through the levels of classes is a good barometer of how good you are. Your teacher feedback is a good barometer. Whether your scenes are getting laughs is a good barometer. But I think you're never going to, no matter how many systems you try to throw in front of it, you're never going to override the human factor of insecurity and fear.
That's true, but I think giving a number grade would do it. Give students a 1, 2, or 3 after every class.
Three means so.
Well, just listen. We'll hear it out. Let's be crazy.
Okay.
3 would mean you are awesome.
Right.
2 means you're fine. No, better than fine. 2 means you're very good. Fine to very good. Like, you're doing well. Like an A, B, or needs improvement.
Okay.
That's it. Like, you're an A, which means like you are on track to be in a team, or like at least that is in contention.
Mm-hmm.
B means nope, you're not there yet. And needs improvement means you got to like put in a serious new level of effort if you want to get to the next level.
Right.
People would not argue with – people respond to quantitative analysis. Like, if they would know if I gave a student that middle grade and they were fucking hoping for that high one, they'd hear it.
Right.
And if I gave somebody that high grade, they'd be cocky.
Right.
Like, that happens in real school. When I was put into an honors class in 8th grade, I believed I was smart. Isn't there some experiment where they put kids who into honors classes who don't test into them and they start doing better?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They believe they're better. Like, people respond to that
assessment. But by your own logic then, won't there be people who get a 2 and then start feeling like they're a 2 kind of player when we could have made them feel like they're better and then they got there?
Yeah, I know, but like you're right, but I'm just trying to think of what message even gets heard, because what we're doing right now is giving this verbal description, and I think it has no effect.
Right.
I think the person feels about themselves whatever they felt before.
What about a report card? Like, not more than just 1, 2, 3. Like, game, support.
Well, first of all, now we're going to start push the boundaries of how much the teachers would be willing to do. Like, 16, like, this guy teaches like 4 or 5 classes a week. He's one of the most responsible people. If I ask him to give that breakdown for every single student, he would burn out. Like, you could
be a lot.
You could do, like, I think a real broad, like, acting game attitude.
Yeah, support. Yeah.
Like, just attitude of, like, hard work, you know, character. How hard do you work? How good an actor are you? How good are you at game? I think you could do something like that. I don't think you could go much more specific than that.
Do you think the teams would be different if you picked them?
Me?
Yeah.
Will Hines?
Yeah,
Will Any Hines. Individual would be different. Like,
I'm just saying there's a not a disconnect, but there's a difference between what Nate does.
Oh, this is true.
And the you run the school, so you see the students more often and see.
This is true.
There are people on the panel of. There are people on the Harold committee that are teachers and see a lot of students.
But Saif is right that it is better. There are times when Nate and I talk and times when we don't. And it's just on. It's better if we do. Just that, and this was true with Anthony. Like, the first year I had this job, I didn't talk to him at all. And then after the auditions, I heard what he assessed. And I was like, oh, fuck, I should have been talking to Anthony because he picks the teams.
Right.
So I got to, like, know if he's got a real – if he's very different than me in some issue, I should at least be aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
It is the theater and the school need to communicate, and we don't always.
I'm just wondering if
but we do, though. Like, and this time we did. Like, before the auditions, I talked to Nate a couple of times and after. Doesn't mean we're going to agree.
Right.
Certainly Nate and I would pick different – people, but any individual would.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think I know where he's coming from. And like John, I think, was saying, like, there's teachers in the room who have seen a lot of the students. Also, I try to give Nate as many advanced classes as he can so he can see the students.
Yeah, that's
like true. Anthony would sometimes teach a lot of advanced and sometimes he wouldn't. It's better if you see them on your feet. I don't know. It is frustrating. You're right. It's something that is.
And there is like a.
I mean, these are all
there's
the
a
series.
Separate.
That I've came up with in the dark room that I now live in.
Oh.
But I don't know. I always think about, like, this is kind of an extreme example, but I don't know if you've ever read Daniel Quinn.
No, never heard of that name.
Wrote a book called Ishmael. He's great. And one of the things he talks about in that book is the idea of, like, every time there's a problem, a government tries to throw a law in front of it.
Yes.
You know, like... you know, so like this, people are doing this. Well, let's make a law that they can't do it. Mm-hmm. Now they're doing this, so let's make another law, or let's throw more money at this problem. That's the solution. Throw more money. Now throw more money. Now throw more laws. Now throw more money, and it never really works. And that's what I feel like a grade system.
You might be right.
Like,
but
it wouldn't solve the problem of.
I don't like walking away. You may ultimately be right, and other people have said as much to me, but I don't like assuming there's no answer. The same way, like, we're trying to solve how to teach game, I'm trying to solve how to communicate to people how they're doing in this subjective art form.
I think that human beings need to meet us. I think that students and people need to meet us halfway in those efforts, which is a very difficult thing to ask of people. But, like, if we're trying to set up feedback,
I agree with
all
that.
These
I'm
things,
doing.
Like,
I'm just trying to do my halfway part.
You also need to do the work on your own end to, like, be more. Art is fucking impossible, you know,
right.
And it is fraught with insecurity.
But we can't walk away from our side
fear.
Of it. Like, we have
We're
to...
not walking away from our side of it at all, but, like, we come into this, like, wanting so much and putting so much importance on this. These are people's lives, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, you're facing a lot of, like, just abject terror from people.
Yeah.
You know, of, like, this is not going to work out. I'm not good at this. I've wasted my time and money and effort. And there's nothing that you can do aside from assigning everybody fucking guidance counselors or, like, you know, emotion. Yeah, grief counselors.
There's a point to which you can go too far. I agree. But I think that if we're going to want to be improv teachers, we have to continually think about it as a way to do it better.
I agree with that.
I wrote some people after my audition and asked them for feedback, and they all gave it to me. You know, it took a while, but. Like, John took the longest, but his was very insightful. I'm not making fun of him. I'm saying, no, like, people do – teachers do care, obviously. You know, like, it's not like –
The
like,
teachers
ah,
all were
off.
In those – they were all Brandon Gardner to some degree of wanting it so badly. They remember it.
Sure.
Yeah. What – can I ask a random question I've thought of?
Sure.
What about – I heard in Chicago they have, like, multiple Harold nights. Like, what about more – Team
yeah, they
possible.
Used to have at I.O. They used to have like 20 teams, 20 house teams or something like that.
Do they still?
Do they still have that? I don't know.
We don't know. Yeah, that's one way you go.
Yeah.
Just wondering.
If the only validation that people accept is being on a team, put everyone in a fucking
be,
team.
Right?
Well,
the teams will be worse. That would happen. The teams will be worse.
Worse.
Yeah.
Maybe that's okay, though. Maybe the level that they drop is worth the boost of esteem that the student body gets.
I mean, even like a... I'm all over the place here, but even like a... late night Harold team, like midnight somewhere. Like,
I mean, Cypher, they
that
did
would do it. Like,
I think, yeah,
they
Lloyd
did expand.
Knight is,
Lloyd Knight added four teams
that
weren't there, and we just added a fifth.
Yeah,
right.
Like that. That's the biggest expansion of the teams that's been since I've been here.
That's
essentially
what it is.
Six Lloyd team, I know.
And I do think that the one thing.
I mean, I'm
great,
glad you're saying this, Cypher, because I think like a lot of people have these feelings that you do, or they have had it. So like, I think you're being honest in a way that's refreshing.
It's good,
but I will say from the other side of it, like this never ends. As soon as you get on a team, you're like, why isn't this team better?
And I was,
all the Lloyd people are like, why aren't I on Herald Knight? All the Herald Knight are like, why am I not on the weekend? The weekend team people are like, why am I not on Torco? Why aren't I getting hired for shows?
Right.
People on shows are like, why am I not on better shows?
Yeah.
And then everybody wants to be Amy Poehler.
Yeah. Right.
And Amy's probably like, Tina Fey's killing it. Well, how come I'm not like, I'm a fuck up. Like, I can't write my own show completely by myself, or I don't even know. Like,
yeah, it's true. And that's the thing that you have to like address is why do I, how do I be comfortable being, having what I have? You know, maybe you got
to
go.
Thank God I had two shows that I had to do after the auditions, or I might have. I might have hit a little fade. I'm glad I didn't, because those shows
I think
were
it's
great.
Good to be grateful for that.
Yeah. And I did the jam, and we've left and you out. I was like, I attacked the jam like a grizzly bear. Like,
well, that's the thing. Even for you, like this is you. You have a lot to be grateful for. I think, like, not a lot of people do. Like, you got this great setup at the jam, or you were like made the jambassador of the, like, you are somebody individually who like has a lot of respect in this community and is doing a lot of stuff and has clearly dove feet first into it and is funny, you know? So like, and I think the goal is like for you to recognize that, and for anybody who feels similar to you is like, what do I have that is great? That is, you know, what do I have that keeps me going?
It's just,
but it's true. It's such a fucking difficult fucking thing to walk through and navigate on both ends. Because us, like, watching the Heralds and putting the teams together, even we go through things of like, fuck, I wish we could put this person on a team. I wish we had a spot for this person. And that often becomes like, well, you know, if a slot opens up, this is a person we'll consider for that, you know?
This is slightly related to the idea of sort of giving affirmations to students and knowing if you're doing well or not, is that one thing that I've tried to do as a teacher that I'm actually get pretty excited about and sort of interested in, and is the idea of a few times I've taken like 201 or 301 level students and sort of put them on an indie team together. I was like, I'm going to make this team. These are eight people that
you made Dreamboat.
Dreamboat.
I made Dreamboat. Yeah. And I've done it with a few teams since then. And I think one, it's sort of nice to do because I think people get better by playing with better people. So it's like, rather than like the regular indie team where it's like half the team's good, half the team is not there all the time and has stopped taking classes, to like eight people that are all super focused. Everyone has like a pretty good basis of like game and everything you needed to be working on. And then everyone now is a little bit more confident than they used to be because they just got selected to do something a little special.
Yeah.
And that's been fun. And I think it's fun to watch how people develop that way.
And I think about it. It doesn't all have to be affirmation. I think telling people if they're not doing well, telling them the truth on that isn't a bad thing to say.
Yeah.
Just like giving some perspective. Yeah. How much is ahead of me is a scary thing.
Maybe like, real quick, sorry. Mm. If you say somebody like, you need to work on this more, and then maybe suggesting a coach that you think is good at teaching that.
Mm.
Because you did that with me with Finelli.
Finelli, yeah.
You're like, I think Finelli would help you some and try working with him.
Right, you play like Finelli. That's cool. At least did.
So, but like, I don't know. You guys are busy. You have a house.
Question of I think it's an emphasis question sometimes. You tell somebody, like, you need to work on this. There's a missing component of that, which is like, how much? Am I a little bit off? Because there was a guy recently who was in advanced. We asked him to go back to 401. Won't say names here. And this person's fine. But they had this thing that they were noted repeatedly, and there was no improvement. And a teacher was finally like, I think this thing has gotten to the point where it's actually holding up the class. And if this person wants to keep taking classes, they'd be better off going to 401 and really focusing on it. So I talked to the student. The student was like, I've been given that note. I didn't know it was that bad. I didn't know it was to the degree.
Mm.
And it was like, the teachers feel like you're not doing anything about this note. And the student was like, I think I am, but I guess it was – if I'd known that it was like to that degree, I just wasn't – and this person was not complaining. They took responsibility, you know. They were just like – they didn't – they heard that note and they didn't know what emphasis was attached to it.
Right.
If it was like, you need to work on this or you shouldn't do this level, they would have like – so that's kind of why I'm thinking like, you need to work on this and the grade I give you is the bottom grade. They'd be like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Or you need to work on this and I give you the top grade. It's like, oh, okay, I'll work on that, but fuck it, I'm doing great. And that would be probably accurate. There are some people who are awesome, like, you got to play more characters, but they're awesome. Mm-hmm. That's just the side of them that is kind of weak. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then to some people, it's like, you got to play more characters because you're not yes-anding, you're not committing, you're holding everything up. Mm-hmm. And they sound the same to the students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you don't get on a team, you're like, oh, I guess I suck. Right. Because that's the only validation that gets heard. Right. Sorry.
Well, I don't know. We'll never figure this out.
Me either. Yeah, we'll never figure it out. I got to get a new job.
Yeah. We should probably wrap it up here, right? We've been
talking for like three hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It looks like this is going to be the first podcast that we don't mention Gramps on. So, sorry about that.
We're not going to mention Gramps at all.
Mod Team Gramps.
Yeah, sorry.
Were you on Gramps, Brandon?
No, I was on iBadger, which was one of the original four. Mixtape 98, and then Stone Cold Fox.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh. Not, that's too bad.
Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Gardner.
Thank you, Cypher.
I was going to say, Brandon's been doing my hip-hop improv show.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, let's talk about that.
What the hell? yeah.
Sorry, it looks like we're all going to...
What have you learned from that?
That show actually has been really fun, because like... having like a half Hot 97 kind of crowd, half UCB crowd is like a super fun thing to play with and see like
what hits.
Yeah.
And are the crowds responding well to that show? Like, are they?
Yeah, I think so. Cypher and I have talked about it. I think like me as a performer, I'm still trying to figure out like the best way to do it. But I think they're enjoying it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sells out. I mean.
Yeah, it really
asses
does.
Asses in seats.
Yep.
Asses in seats.
That's what counts.
It's a measurable validation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's also, if I tell students the shows that I do, if I mention that one, that's the one that they get the most excited about.
Yeah.
They're like, wait, what?
What if you tell them you're friends with the Brothers Hinds? How does that go over? to no effect? Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and thank you, Keaton. We didn't thank Keaton.
Yeah, thank you, Keaton. All right. Thanks, Will.
Thanks, John.
Bye.
Legal.